Okay. It is now my honor and pleasure to introduce our speaker, Molly.
Someone will flash me at some point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not like that.
Hi, everybody. I'm Molly.
Hi.
I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I wanted to start with a page from Courage to Change from January 19th. That's about the recovery process. And for me, you know, feels a lot like what recovery has been like for me and what I really want to focus on tonight. So again, it's January 19th. Thank you. This microphone's like seriously intimidating, but I will work on it. Okay, today I seek to become a little more accepting of myself, a little more comfortable in my own skin. Although it's important to recognize and admit my limitations and flaws, only my higher power can remove them. Condemning my imperfections has never enhanced my appreciation of life or helped me to love myself more. Perhaps I can let go of all condemnation for this one day. I will recognize that I'm on a spiritual path of self-improvement. Every tiny step I take on that path moves me closer to wholesomeness, to wholeness, health, and serenity. If I become impatient with myself, I can examine my expectations. Perhaps I expect recovery to happen overnight. I will take time today to acknowledge my efforts and to trust the process of the Al-Anon program. And the reminder is, Al-Anon is a gentle healing program. I'll remember to be gentle with myself today, trusting that the healing will come. And the quote is, today I can accept myself for what I am because I know that whatever happens, I have a higher power and a group of people who will love me anyway. Al-Anon's been a really incredibly important process in my life. I don't think I ever felt a part of something and like I belong to anything until I came to Al-Anon. I would not think of myself as a joiner and sort of had a very deep outsider complex coming from the home that I grew up in. And Al-Anon was this amazing place where I felt so accepted from the first day. It was really incredible. I've been thinking a lot and journaling and sharing a lot about my stepmother who was the reason I came into Al-Anon. She was a longtime member of Al-Anon. She did not invite me to Al-Anon. She never asked me to come with her. She never really talked about it. And what finally got me to Al-Anon, people had suggested it numerous times in my life. And I had always thought, oh my God, that sounds awful. Like, you want me to go to a place and talk about my mother with other people talking about their like crazy family members. Like, that sounds awful. I have no interest in that. I live 3,000 miles away. That's not a conversation I need to have. So I had avoided Al-Anon for many years. And what got me finally to come to Al-Anon, it was about 11 years ago, my stepmom got very sick. And I got very angry. That was my reaction to her getting sick, was to get angry. Because she was the first person in my life who really felt like a parent. She was the first person who did really simple things. She used to tell me later on, I didn't learn this for a while, but whenever she would take on a new sponsee, she'd make sure that they weren't walking around in underwear with holes in them. That you need to, you know, take care of yourself in very basic ways. And she was the first person who came into my life and made sure that I had clothes to wear that didn't have holes in them. And made sure, I was 19 when she came into my life, and made sure that I had the money to buy books for college. And just, you know, really basic things, but that was not the family I came from. You know, and I, thankfully for the program, I have a wonderful relationship with my family today. And I can really recognize that my parents did the best they could with what they had. They were folks who, you know, just had broken pieces of them. And my perception of my childhood was that I was unwanted, unloved, and alone. That was what alcoholism felt like to me. But that was, I don't think that was the truth. but that's how it felt. And I also should say, I'm my own qualifier for this program. I feel like my mother does not identify as an alcoholic, and it's not my place to put any labels on her. Was pretty much kind of abandoned by his family and never saw them again after he was 19. My grandmother never talked to her family after her 20s. We actually don't even know my grandfather's real name because he changed his identity and he never told anyone his true identity. He made up a name for himself and an identity. On my father, that was on my mother's side. On my father's side, his family were Jewish immigrants, and his mother struggled with mental illness. And he never felt like he belonged. And so I just come from a long line of people who feel deeply uncomfortable in their skin. And I, you know, from as long as I can remember, felt deeply uncomfortable in my skin. And we each sort of mitigate, how we feel deeply, how to change feeling deeply uncomfortable in our skin. For some people, alcohol or other drugs help them with that feeling. For others of us, it's control. And perfection. But everybody is constantly trying to be somebody they're not in my family. And like I said, it wouldn't have mattered if anybody ever picked up a drink because that was just so deep in the roots on both sides of my family. My parents they wanted to fix themselves and they wanted to fix the brokenness. And their answer were to become back to the Landers, which was this thing in the 70s where you reject city life and you go and you live off the land. So I grew up on a gorgeous farm in Maine. I grew up in the most beautiful place. I wanted to get as far away as possible, and that's why I'm in Los Angeles. My daughter now, my daughter has decided she wants to be a farmer, and I'm like, are you kidding? Like, what is wrong with you? I worked so hard to get to a city. Like, you're crazy. But yeah, you know, that's the way it is in families. It's like, it's in her blood somewhere, and that's what she wants. So I grew up in a beautiful, beautiful place. And I think the idea was if, you know, we never picked up sugar and we ate off the land and, you know, people worked themselves to death trying to, you know, keep the thing going, all the other stuff would melt away, which of course it did not melt away. And I decided the way to get around it was to steal candy bars. It was just, it's like you have this vision, and then there's what really happens. So like I said, for all their attempts, I grew up with that feeling of being unwanted, unloved, and alone. Our family had a lot of weird dynamics, and it's a super complicated family because it was my mother's third marriage and my father's second marriage, and, I had a half-sister I grew up with who ended up becoming totally estranged from the family, as is the family tradition. She doesn't speak to anybody in the family anymore. So it was this complicated family. I felt very lost and invisible. And I ended up, on my 15th birthday, my mother told me I could, stop acting out and stay at home, or I could leave for good, and I left for good. So I left for good at 15, bounced around a lot. I can't count how many places I lived between 15 and 25, just sort of went all over the place. And I was dying to get to 18 because I thought, then I'm gonna be normal. Because then other people won't be living with their parents too. And then I'll just be like one of them. And like, it's all gonna be good. I'm gonna get to 18. I'm not gonna seem like the freak who doesn't have a family. And it's gonna be great. I got to 18. And then I felt like a freak because I was so used to being on my own. I was like, oh yeah, paying rent, I got that down. And working, got that down. And really realized that I was somebody who, like, I never hugged people. Everybody was at arm's length. I mean, I just had these really serious walls up, really wanted to not be that person, who stood there stiff as a board when you hugged me, and tried all sorts of stuff. And, you know, like I said, around that time, my stepmother came into my life, a really loving, beautiful presence who I felt totally accepted by, and that was wonderful. You know, and I did well on the outside. I had that just sort of hyper independence, and I could get by. I was great at jobs. I mean, you know, folks come in here a lot and they tell horror stories about working because Al-Anons are the best employees. We're so great because we say yes to everything. So I was a great employee. I would just work my tail off, you know, and did well on the outside. And then, you know, at a certain point, I got married. And was sort of trying to figure out how to do that. I was desperate to sort of find home after those like 10 years of not really having a stable place that was mine. I was desperate to sort of settle down and find home and find what that looked like. I think I scared my poor husband to death with my like, okay, we're gonna root and we're gonna buy a house and we're gonna do this. And then at a certain point, my stepmom got really sick. She had chronic health issues, and she had an aneurysm in her aorta and almost died and was in this very sick state for 11 years and passed away in September of this past year. But she got sick, and I got super angry because up to that point, I did not grow up with any faith. My parents... you know, really reject, particularly my mother, really rejected God. Like, that was like a really not okay thing to talk about. So I didn't grow up with any faith, any spiritual life whatsoever, but I'd always kind of believed in karma. Like, if you, at least if you like do good stuff in the world, good stuff will come to you. And when my stepmom got sick, I just had this full-on breakdown. You know, now I can understand it was a real spiritual crisis because here was this wonderful, loving woman, and she was so sick and she was suffering so horribly. She was in the hospital for months. It was just really, really ugly and awful. And there was my mother who drank like a fish, you know, treated people pretty horribly, you know, again, doing the best she could, but, you know, a lot of wreckage sort of following her. And she was healthy as a horse. I mean, she could, you know, put down so much alcohol and just be so healthy. And my stepmother, who like didn't eat sugar and like was so careful and like, you know, was so sick. And I just thought, what's the point? You know, like what is the point if you can, you know, cause all this wreckage in the world and you can cause all this good and it doesn't mean anything? And so I was having this full-on spiritual crisis, and people kept suggesting Al-Anon, and I'd done a lot of outside help, which had helped, but it kept me really in my head. It was one of those things where, you know, I could talk about my problems endlessly and analyze them, and I could diagnose them and put labels on them, and I could explain them, but it didn't necessarily change anything in my heart. So people kept mentioning it, and so I finally decided to go. I've got some of the wonderful women from my Thursday night South Pasadena meeting here. That was the first meeting I ever went to, was the Thursday night South Pass meeting. I have no idea what was said in that first meeting. I mean, it could have been in a different language. I remember being at like my fourth meeting and being like, I've never seen the 12 steps. And someone was like, you know, we read them at every meeting. And I was like, oh, I hadn't heard that. I was sitting in the chairs and not realizing the 12 steps were being read. So I really have no idea what people were saying. But it was amazing to walk into a room and just be surrounded by people who just wanted to get better. Like, no other agenda whatsoever. No selling you this, no like, you know, join this religion. It was just, we just wanna, and it wasn't even get better. It was just, I just wanna feel better. It was just a room of people who wanted to feel better in their skin. And man, did I need that. I really, really needed that at that moment. The other thing that was going on was that, you know, I had gotten married, I'd bought a house, I had a great job, and I didn't feel good. It didn't, none of that mattered. It didn't, I had everything that I sort of supposedly wanted, and did not feel better or fulfilled. There was just always something wrong. I had developed a really intense inner critic, a very, very powerful inner critic, which is still something that, you know, I work with my higher power on, that internal critic. And one of the things which I never would have thought was something I was struggling with, and I've had to do a lot of work on, and it was actually, gratitude's a very, very big part of my program. And at a certain point, I realized that gratitude is sort of the antidote of self-pity. And I never would have thought that I was somebody who walked around with a lot of self-pity. But that's what was going on, an extraordinary amount of self-pity. And, you know, just could not, I couldn't see my blessings. I couldn't enjoy my blessings when I came into the rooms. You know, every single thing about Al-Anon terrified me. The 12 steps terrified me. The God thing terrified me. Getting a sponsor terrified me. Being of service terrified me. Like, everything. I mean, still to this day, breaks can be a little uncomfortable, and it's been a while. And it can still be uncomfortable and awkward. But I kept coming back. I found a sponsor by asking the person who I was least scared to approach in the rooms. So, like, people are like, look for someone who has the recovery you want. That was not my strategy. It was like, the person who's not going to reject me, that's what I'm going for. And I had a wonderful, lovely first sponsor, a really, really lovely, very gentle and loving woman, which is what I needed. So came into the rooms terrified, terrified to talk to anybody, but, you know, kept coming back just because it felt good. And didn't completely know if I belonged. Like I said, you know, my mother does not self-identify as an alcoholic, and it took me a long time to really understand the family disease, and that was a really great tool. That recommendation that you really come to understand alcoholism and the family disease, it helped to read 12-step literature and AA literature. I know we're supposed to only talk about Al-Anon, but I will say it helped me a lot to go to open AA meetings, to read AA literature, to listen to AA speakers. I'm a big fan. We always call them speaker tapes, but they're not speaker, whatever we're getting, speaker files, I guess we're listening to these days. Speaker files have been really helpful to my recovery. So started learning about it, started understanding how I was my own qualifier, what really brought me into the rooms, and started working the steps super gently, super slowly. You know, I had never had any expectation that I could change my mother. I will say I was free of that. I didn't think I was ever going to get her sober, and had never tried. She's a very, very powerful force, and I never had any misconceptions that I was going to change her. So when it was in working the first step, I was like, oh yeah, powerless. So powerless over alcoholism. I get that. Way powerless. And it was the unmanageable part that was really where I had to work the step, was to understand how I made my life unmanageable. How worrying, how anxiety, how beating myself up, all those actions, holding on so tight, working so hard to make things look good, thinking that that was gonna make me feel better. And one of the ways I made my life unmanageable is I spent all my time thinking about the future. I was so not present in what was going on today, because it was always about, like, what can I make happen tomorrow that's gonna make you love me? Like, if I just do this, and if I accomplish this, and if I say this the right way, you're gonna love me. I was desperate to find that love, and really thought that it was all about what I was doing on the outside would bring that to me, and was making myself just crazy and making my life unmanageable by doing all of that. And that was a big part of working the first step for me. When I came in, like I said, I was super terrified about the God stuff. Like, that was so not okay in my family. And thankfully, somebody who I knew was in program and had known before program, I sat down with her pretty early on, and I was like, it's really nice. The meetings are lovely. The God thing, like, I don't think the God thing's going to work for me. And she was so great about it. She's like, oh, just don't worry about it. She was like, just, it's no big deal. Don't worry about it. You'll figure it out when it's time. Which was exactly what I needed to hear, because I was worrying about it and feeling like I didn't belong because of that piece. And the steps are beautiful, because the second step is so, like, came to believe. Like, it's so gentle. Like, just open the door a little bit. Like, is it possible that things could get better with a higher power? That was all it was. It's like, is it possible? And that was fine. I could do that. I was like, well, maybe it's anything's possible. Okay. It could get better. And I feel like on the third step, I'm still working it every day, every single day, working on turning my life over. You know, I don't think I've got that down after even years in the program. That's one that's a daily practice. And it's not even like a daily practice. Like, it's like a minute by minute practice of if I can do that, if I can really turn it over. And then, you know, the fourth step, you know, when I'm talking to folks about the first step, I'm always like, it kind of gets darker before it gets better when you go into the fourth step. At least that was my experience. It definitely got darker before it got better. It was very transformative for me. I think I thought that I'd done a lot of damage in the world. You know, and really where the fourth step, where I really needed to work, was the damage I'd done to myself. It was really helpful to work through my resentments. I used the column method and really tried to figure out what my part was in my resentments. And there was a lot to unpack there, and there was a lot of unexpected stuff. You know, with everything, with the drinking in my life and the way my family was, I was surprised that one of the areas I held on so tightly to resentment was dealing with my parents' partners. Both my parents are like they're funny when it comes to relationships, and there was a lot of inappropriate situations I was put in. You know, I'm sort of dealing with a few. There's a couple new partners now. It was an interesting thing. I really didn't think that's where the deep resentment was going to be, and really had to work through that. And it all tied back to me. It all tied back to what my behavior was. My parents divorced when I was 11. And my reaction to being in this very volatile environment where it was really sort of valued, you know, to always have these new girlfriends and boyfriends coming into our life, and, you know, they'd move in before I'd even met them, and there'd be this new guy living there. And that was so valued that my reaction to puberty was like, it's all about boyfriends. Like, I just gotta get boyfriends. And I had a lot of inappropriate behavior because I thought that's where your value came from. So again, like, I had this resentment against my parents, but it wasn't really about what they'd done. It was how I had internalized it. I had read the messages of what was happening and thought that I had to engage in this really inappropriate behavior myself. And I had to forgive myself about the behavior I'd engaged in to really let go of the resentment that I was harboring there. And I still have to work on that. Like I said, I've got a couple new partners to deal with on both sides of my biological parents. And I still have to work on it. And work on letting go of that and letting them lead their own lives and realize it has nothing to do with me. You know, it really doesn't matter who they're dating or what their relationship looks like. That has no, that's their lives, and getting that detachment from it and letting it be what it's going to be. So a lot of work, you know, and I have to say, like, I needed a lot of support through my fourth to work through all of that and to work through the various inventories my sponsor had me do. And I had to really take my time to work it. You know, and as I moved through the fifth step and the sixth step, having to learn about God's time, that's one of the things I really loved in the reading I started with. It's like, it's not mine to take the character defects away. Like, I don't get to do that. That happens on God's time. You know, and there's still going to be days where I am wallowing in self-pity. You know, I think the way my higher power works is that my character defects, they never fully go away. I might have them less. I might not live in them the same way I did before. You know, maybe I'll have a day of feeling self-pity instead of 2 months of feeling self-pity today. But it happens on God's time. It doesn't happen on my time. And I also realized a lot of them were very tied into assets. And that if I could experience them in moderation, they actually sometimes bring some positive things into my life. You know, it's not good to be just judgmental. Like, that doesn't help me when I'm judging other people. But it is good to be intuitive about people. And to listen to my gut when it tells me something about somebody else. I don't have to gossip. I don't have to criticize. I certainly don't need to talk to other people about what I think of somebody. But it doesn't hurt to have that thing in my gut that tells me, like, oh, that person might need help right now. I should really be aware of that. Sometimes that can be really positive. So figuring out that how to sort of work with my higher power to be in moderation. You know, and my ninth step, one of my favorite stories about my ninth step is my mother-in-law and I had a hard time together. As I said, like, when I married my husband, like, I was looking for approval big time. Like, I wanted that approval. I was just living for that approval. And my mother-in-law was not gonna give it. That was not, she was not into the approval thing, so that wasn't going to happen. And I retreated from her because of that. If you're not going to give me the approval, like, the walls are going up. And I just, you know, the idea, I was never alone with her. I really kept my distance with her. When my kids were born, not that long after I came into Al-Anon, and this was funny because I felt, like, wildly unprepared to be a parent, and I ended up having twins. Fun. So it was funny because, like, there was no reason for me to have twins. There were no twins in the family, no nothing. And when the doctor told me, I was like, but that doesn't happen to normal people. I don't think you understand who I am. I am a normal person, and that's not in the realm of possibilities. That wasn't in the instructional manual. Like, what do you mean you can just have twins for no reason? I was terrified, terrified to become a parent, terrified of two infants. I really had never been around infants. Because I was so like, I'm gonna get a home now. I had kids long before any of my friends, so I had nobody around me and had kids. I really had no idea what I was doing. And my mother-in-law was super helpful. This woman who had always sort of, like, I had such a hard time, was so helpful, so wonderful, by far the most supportive parent in our lives. At that point, my stepmom was super sick. You know, my dad was totally consumed with taking care of her. And my mother-in-law turned out to be the person who was super supportive. And so when I worked my ninth step and made amends to her, my amends to her were about the fact that I had been so insecure when I married my husband, so deeply insecure, and that had really prevented me from building a relationship with her and really getting to know her. And I was so grateful that we had now, you know, had a chance to get to know each other, and, you know, that we that I just loved her so much and was so sad that we had spent those years without that relationship because of my insecurity. And she said, well, you know, I really didn't like your tattoos. I was like, what? What are you talking about? Like, I mean, I do have tattoos, but I was like, what? She's like, I just thought you were a social deviant, and you were, you know, this, and I was like, I am a social deviant, first of all. Like, yes, I'm a nonconformist here, but I was like, it was so funny because It was like the most ridiculous thing. I thought she was judging me because she didn't think I was good enough for her son, because I wasn't nice enough, I wasn't something enough for her. And it ended up being like the most superficial thing in the face of the earth. And I was like, oh my God, I so don't care about that. Like, that's on you. Like, you're welcome to judge me all you want about the tattoos. You know, you don't get tattoos for other people to like them. It was just, it was the most amazing of all the ninth steps I worked and all the amends. Like, that one was the biggest, like, weight lifted off my shoulders. I was like, I didn't do anything wrong in that relation. Well, I mean, like I said, I was insecure and I didn't get to know her. But, like, the thing that initially triggered that uncomfortableness in the relationship was so silly and so ridiculous, and yet it affected us for years. And I was just so grateful to work through that with her. You know, as I, well, I do want to say something about my 10th step real quick. You know, I was saying earlier, gratitude became this, and still to this day is a huge part of my program. I do a daily gratitude list. It helps me be really present in today, you know, like what happened today. But on my gratitude list, what I'm focused on is what blessings did God bestow on me today? What grace did God bestow on me? Because, you know, I make a lot of mistakes. And that grace is really beautiful when it's bestowed on you. I feel like sometimes that grace and mercy is when I feel my higher power the most. It's such an amazing thing when you fall on your face. And you just get picked back up with that grace and mercy. But the other thing I in my gratitude list, I have gratitude for and try and notice is what opportunities for serenity we're in today. And I was doing my gratitude list yesterday, and man, I took advantage of no opportunities for serenity yesterday. It was a tough day at work. It was stressful. I went straight from work to an appointment with my son. I just took no time for myself. I've been, you know, so far this year, it's early in the year, eating healthy. I was like wolfing down a chocolate crepe yesterday. Like, I mean, it was just, I just did none of that. And that's part of how I work my 10th step. It's like, I could see at the end of the day yesterday, I was like, oh, look at that. I did absolutely nothing to cultivate serenity in my day to day. I was like, guess I have to do tomorrow differently. And that's how I work my 10th step, is just that nightly gratitude list about my blessings, grace, and what have I done around serenity for the day. And it really, like I said, it keeps me super grounded in each day and really helps with that daily check-in and figuring out how to sort of like, okay, just need to readjust tomorrow a little bit to be a little different. A lot of times on my gratitude list is the opportunity to be a better parent tomorrow. I worked a lot of fourth steps around how I talk to my kids. I have two beautiful kids, two very strong kids, big personalities. And so there's a lot of days where I'm struggling in how I am as a parent to them. Kindness was not, that was not something I grew up with. Gentleness, kindness, just not part of what I grew up with. Also not what I looked for in a partner when I found my husband. You know, I was looking for somebody whose sort of brokenness fit my brokenness. We found each other. You know, so it takes a lot of work to bring kindness into our family. I should say my husband brings lots of wonderful things into our family. Such a wonderful sense of humor. I don't know about you guys, but like growing up with alcoholism, not so great for your sense of humor. That is not always one of my strong points. So I'm so grateful that, you know, there's all these things he can bring into our family. But yeah, I often thank God for the opportunity to be a different parent tomorrow and to, you know, bring that kindness and gentleness to my children and work on not being triggered by kids just being kids. You know, they're just being kids. And that's often very triggering for me. So once I got to my 11th step, I did not want to get off my 11th step. Like, first of all, I was convinced, I was like, I'm not doing enough for my spiritual growth. Like that critical voice immediately came in on the 11th step. I was like, I need to like find a meditation retreat, and like I have to have a regular practice, and like, is there a certain minimum number of minutes of meditation a week before you can get off your 11th step? I mean, I spent a long time on that 11th step, convinced that I wasn't doing it right, and petrified of the 12th, because I didn't want to go to 12, because it was like, what if the spiritual awakening doesn't happen for me? I am always convinced that like recovery might not happen for me. That was a big part of who I was growing up. Was this sense that, and that's who I was when I came into the rooms, and it's still there underneath. I felt so damaged, so damaged. Like I said, I had been such an outsider as a kid. I was an outsider in my family. I was an outsider at school. I was really intensely bullied at school. I just felt like, you know, I'm just too broken for this spiritual awakening thing to happen to me. And so I stayed on the 11th for a long time because I did not want to go to 12 only to find out like, tricked ya, not happening for you. You know, it was a funny thing. It was super gentle when I worked my 12th step. I had also, because I had, I don't know how many folks are in the room with young kids, but like, because I came into program and had kids pretty quickly after coming into program, I always felt like I didn't work the program the way like those ladies who like are retired work the program. Like they're going to meetings every day. Like these people who are like, I call my sponsor every day. God bless you. You are wonderful if you talk to your sponsor every day. That's amazing. I could never talk to my sponsor every day. I tried weekly check-ins with my sponsor. That fell apart. Then it became like, I'm going to try and call every month. You know, and so I always felt like I wasn't working the program. You weren't supposed to work it. And I got to my 12th step and all of a sudden realized like, I have two regular meetings a week, very consistently. I read my daily literature every day. I'll talk about my sponsee in a minute, but I, at the time I had a sponsor, I had sponsees. Like, all of a sudden I realized like, oh, I'm working the full thing. Like, I'm doing the whole thing. I got the tools, I got the literature. Like, it happened, it really happened. And also, I think that for me, the spiritual awakening was like, I'm okay in my skin. Like being in my skin today, you know, not always. There's certain super awkward times. When I did my fourth step, I named my character defects, and one of them is the weirdo. Like sometimes I still go back into being the weirdo. Like sometimes I feel like that person in the room, but not most days, which is pretty amazing. I've, since working my steps, I've been trying to figure out like, okay, so what comes next? Like I worked the 12 steps, like what happens now? Tried to sort of start them again, and it wasn't working. And so I've been working on what I call my Al-Anon reboot. That's sort of where I am today. I realized I really needed to talk to people who'd worked the steps a second time. And it's been hard to find folks. If there's folks in the room who've worked the steps a second time, please come talk to me after the meeting. I've been doing coffee dates with folks, just talking about, okay, so how did you approach the steps a second time? Like, did you work them a different way? Did you work them with a different person? One of the things that's been part of my Al-Anon reboot is trying to do H&I work. I was just emailing with the woman who's coordinating the H&I work I'm a part of today, who's in the program, and she's like, this is really teaching me patience, because we're all having trouble getting our clearances because the panel's in the jail and it's really hard to get the clearance. And it's like, okay, I'm supposed to be there tomorrow. Guess I'm not going to be there. Okay. So lots of opportunities there. But yeah, just trying to be of service in a different way, trying to talk to folks and learn about how folks sort of approached recovery after you've been in it for a while. It's different. I've been through some serious ebbs and flows in my recovery. The one thing that does stay consistent for me, even when nothing else feels like it's working, is just showing up in the rooms. Sometimes I have to show up in the rooms for a few months. I remember in one of my sort of deepest sort of pits in the program where I really felt like, God, like, is it not working anymore? Like, is the magic gone? Like, when you first come in, you know, for the newcomers, part of why we love having you here is because we're totally envious of you. Because, like, when you first come into the rooms and you get that first burst of recovery, it's so magical. It's so beautiful. I remember like being in the car with my husband and being like, let go and let God. It's so easy. Like, it's amazing. That's all you gotta do. You just let go and let God and it's all better. And my husband was like, you're crazy. But that early recovery is so beautiful and it gets harder. It gets harder after you've been in the rooms a long time and you feel like, God, is the magic still there? Is it happening for me? And so I was in a really, a few years ago, I was in like a super low point of like, oh man, it is just not happening. And I was at a meeting and I don't even remember, like someone came up to me after the meeting who I'd never talked to before and just said something really kind. And I just felt that deep sense of fellowship. I don't know if you ever get that sometimes, but I just felt that like intense connection. To what we have in these rooms. It's such an amazing thing, and I'm so grateful to everyone who's here tonight because it doesn't matter if we've ever spoken before, we have this bond, and it's really extraordinary. And she just said something kind to me after the meeting, and I felt the bond. Like, it was all there, and it was all back. It was really, really amazing. The program's been so helpful in all aspects of my life. You know, whether it's parenting, whether it's my marriage, whether it's my relationships, been super helpful in work. I was, like I said, really focused on getting that outside appearance to like look a certain way so that you'd love me. And I, you know, was that person who was always going 110% at work. Everybody I worked with hated me, but you know, I thought I was doing a great job. I remember one of the things that was really amazing about my, when I was working my fourth step, is that I also had to go through this thing called like a 360 degree process that you do in like work environments sometimes, which is where you have to get feedback from like everybody who works with you. Like, you get this like intense level of feedback and everybody's names is taken off of it and you just get this like synthesized thing, you know. And like, there was all this stuff in mind about like, why does Molly have to talk so much, you know, because that's what I did at work. That's how I tried to get approval and love, is like, I always have the answer. Man, do I have the answer. You know, which just drove people around me crazy because I would just jump in with that answer before anyone else had a chance to talk. And it made me a really not fun person to work with. Even though like it looked really good on the employee evaluation that I always had the answer and always had the project done first, it actually made other people around me you know, really unhappy. And you know, I hope I've changed who I am in the work environment. Sometimes it still comes up, but it's a great Al-Anon tool, shutting up. It's a powerful one. You just shut up and things get better. And that's like my biggest tool at work, is just shut up. You know, and I feel, you know, that feeling of being a part of that I never had anywhere before I came into the rooms, like all of a sudden you do start to notice it in these other environments. I do feel a part of the team that I work with today. I never felt that way before. I never made friends at work, and I always knew there was something a little weird about that. I was like, I think other people make friends at work, and I don't. Now I do. The fellowship and a lot of, I think, what happened is I learned what it is just to be human. That it's okay to have tons of faults. And that's sometimes when people feel the closest to you. I always joke that, like, nobody's gonna think they're better, that I'm a better mom than me, that I'm a better mom than them when they walk into my house because it's so dirty. You know, like, sometimes that's when people feel closest to you. When I walk into the home of another parent and it's a total wreck, I'm like, awesome, not making me feel bad about myself, thank you. You know, that when we're vulnerable and when we're, like, in letting people see all those imperfections is a lot of times when people feel closest to us. So by learning to be human and learning to let go, I've learned sort of how to connect with people and feel a part of and feel fellowship in other environments, which has just been an extraordinary, extraordinary gift. I think I'm probably going to end there. Oh, I have 5 minutes. I don't have 5 minutes to say stuff, so I'm going to end there. And you guys can tell me what you do when speakers can't fill the whole time. Thank you so much.